March of 2021, the United States had begun mass vaccinations for COVID-19. By mid-June, most states authorized full capacity gatherings for the first time in nearly a year and a half. During this period, the box office broke $100 million for the first time since early 2020, but overall, sales and theater reopening seemed to lag. Even with a late reopening of the LA and New York markets, the movie exhibition industry had yet to fully recover. Was quarter one the first step to a larger recovery to come, or a portent of the recovery that is not to be? As many places around the globe were still being devastated by COVID-19, the film industry attempted its largest recovery in history. Then suddenly, sending ripples through the industry, two iconic studios were announced for acquisition. Each quarter, a different Hollywood outsider and I will document and discuss the inside of the industry in real time. Four episodes, four outsiders, four questions. I'm Jason from Binge Movies, and this is The State of Cinema, Quarter 2. Guest is Jake Thomas, a writer and filmmaker for his entire life. Jake was employed at Warner Brothers until 2020. He worked in the studio's tour department, among other places, while continuing to work on his craft. Jake has spent the last year and a half enduring one of the tightest lockdowns in the country while observing the upheaval of his industry and livelihood from home. We join my conversation with Jake now.
I'd be really curious how the theaters and the studios come to terms with the fact that we had kind of a blanket 14 months where it was understood that you couldn't really expect to get your money back if you released money in a theater because of the amount of closures. And so studios kind of had a leeway to shorten the theatrical window by a substantial amount, a lot of it day and date, like with HBO Max. And they're not going to do that in 2022, but I really bet that there's probably going to be a tug of war over between theaters and exhibitors of being like, theaters maybe want to go back to a longer theatrical window of 60, 90 days rather than, you know, like a month or 2 weeks. And I'd be curious if that turns into a really big argument between the two parties.
You would say right now, kind of the biggest thing swirling around is really a combination of those two things. It is both the mergers and acquisitions, namely AT&T offloading a media brand, one of the historic media brands that they acquired over, I think, a 3 or 4 year process.
It was a long process, yeah.
They bought it for $85 billion, and then they sold it to Discovery for $45 billion.
That took a long time. My history with working at Warner Brothers, I was in the studio tour department, and even an acquisition as big as that was affected us, too, because like AT&T going through all the accountant books and everything, we had to do some changes on our end, clean up some things, just kind of like know that we were, when we were even like scheduling people or having to keep people a little bit longer to do a little extra work to, you know, prep some carts or, you know, tend to some exhibits and things like that. Just had to be mindful that, you know, like time cards and payroll and all that stuff was being scrutinized through this acquisition. And then the government, of course, got involved with the prior administration, which I still believe was far more centered around the prior president's disapproval of the news networks that were under Warner Media and Turner and like CNN and all that. And I think that was a big influence on that, because no one, like, you know, when Disney buys Fox and they don't acquire Fox News necessarily, there's no stink raised. Yeah, but I was working there starting in 2013 part-time and then full-time 2014. And this would have started at least like 2016, 2017. This was one of the big goals and focuses of the prior CEO, the head of the studio, whose name was Kevin Sugihara, for those that don't know. And he was there for 5 years, 2013, 2018. At least two, maybe 3 years of this were kind of the prep for the purchase. And like, yeah, and then like right before the Justice Department eventually like lost the case and they won with regards to defending it against being a monopoly or anything like that. And then AT&T could go ahead and do this. And then, I mean, they had events on the studio lot. This one called AT&T Shape, which they started hosting just as kind of a test to see if they could do technology expos on back lots. And so, like, that had a direct effect on the tour as well, because we had to, for I think like a day out of the year, completely shut down and close, because we were doing rotating tours for expo attendees and investors rather than ticket holders. So, you know, yeah, it was affecting really every facet of what it was like to work there, even if you worked in the smallest of departments. Right when they're going to like announce like, hey, we can move forward with this and everything, then allegations against Sugihara come out from the one actress that was in kind of like this pass around ring between him and other actors. And so then he resigns and Ann Sarnoff takes over, and then they kind of move forward not only with the, you know, integration of AT&T and Warner Media, but also then like they completely changed the logo. Well, not completely, it's still the same two letters, W and B, so that's good. But the logo itself reformatted. They even repainted the water tower for the first time in probably 15, 20 years, all this stuff. So it's just interesting to see how much prep went into such a big merger, and now it's like less than 2 years, like what, two years or something like that. It's kind of being just like, you know what, we're going to do this with Discovery, which you don't, I can kind of see a little bit, because Discovery, there seems like there could be a strength, because Discovery does a lot of non-scripted stuff and Warner Media is far more focused on scripted content.
AT&T had spent years trying to acquire Warner Media, but now, after only a few short years and billions of dollars of investment, they were spinning the company off and handing it over to Discovery Plus. I asked Jake, from the inside, if he had any insights as to why this happened. What went wrong? Was there a culture clash between AT&T and Warner Brothers / Warner Media? Jake, of course, working there at the time, knew the inside story and answered.
Probably the big point that was maybe showed the disconnect between the two sides of AT&T Warner Media was how Jason Kilar announced the HBO Max day and date streaming that was happening in 2021 this year. Because that was the big thing last year, where Wonder Woman kept pushing back through 2020. And eventually it was released day and date on Christmas. And they had like, he sat down and they had like, you know, individual conversations with Patty Jenkins, with Gal Gadot, talking about kind of reworking the deal so that they still felt compensated, even though their back end dollars were not going to be nearly the amount if it was a pure theatrical release followed by TVOD and home video, you know, 90 days later or something like that. But the fact that they did not do that for the entire slate remaining, it was kind of like a decision that was announced in the news and rather than individually brought up on phone calls with, you know, Denis Villeneuve for Dune, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who just had In the Heights come out in theaters and on HBO Max, and just other filmmakers, like they didn't get that same courtesy that Jenkins and Gadot and the Wonder Woman filmmakers got. It might have been that maybe that kind of whole episode revealed that like AT&T is maybe just not used to entertainment. So then you have Ann Sarnoff and the people in charge of Warner Brothers proper kind of having to do the damage control that AT&T started with that. And I'm sure that rubbed Warner Brothers, like not just the filmmakers, but the folks who work, the assistants that work at the desks of the development executives and the creative executives. And the people who work in the cafeteria who are serving these folks lunch because they're bringing all this anger in, and you know, yeah, it affects everybody. There's so many jobs within entertainment, and decisions at the top really affect all of them to the smallest degree.
One of the unintended consequences of the global pandemic in the film industry was the upheaval of the exclusive theatrical window, which had been set in stone for decades. When Warner Media decided to release their films on their own streaming service on the same day that they would be released in theaters, it sent shockwaves through the industry, and it was reviled by both the exhibition arm of the industry and the creatives. The question, of course, is now that the pandemic, at least in the United States, seems to be mostly under control, what lessons were learned? Was the theatrical window permanently altered, or as these media companies move further and further towards their own streaming service, what does that have to say about the rest of 2021 and the future of entertainment as we know it? Will the day and date of theatrical exhibition ever go back to the way it was?
And this is interesting because I wonder if each company, and this doesn't just apply to Warner Brothers and Warner Media, but you know, Disney Plus, Paramount Plus, all the pluses, if you release a movie, theatrical movie, for, you know, let's say 60 days in theaters, and then traditionally what would happen like after 90 days is then it would go to then go into the home video market with a transactional VOD where you could then buy it on iTunes, Amazon, and then go to a subscription-based several months after that, which was, it's on Netflix, it's on HBO, and then it's on advertising VOD where it's, you know, at a Tubi or something like that. I'm curious if that order could change, where each studio releases a movie in theaters. So like you've got Black Widow coming out later this year, and then maybe after 40, 60 days, it becomes a Disney Plus exclusive for a month before becoming available to own, to kind of drive more people who, I mean, a lot of people have Disney right now, but maybe drive more people to do a subscription and maybe do that in lieu of, because they were doing the $30 premium for some new releases, not all, but Mulan had that and so on. But that, I mean, that might be interesting, is if you just kind of like, since each studio essentially owns their own direct-to-consumer streamer, if they just swap the order of, hey, instead of doing transactional purchases prior to being on a subscription streaming service, we're going to flip that because we also now own the subscription streaming service. It's not being licensed to Netflix or Amazon necessarily, even though, and then it would become available to buy from those third party retailers and in stores. When we were growing up, it was like, you know, bring it home today, and you had to go buy the physical VHS and then later on the DVD, and you had all the with included that you had ownership of a film library because it was an actual physical thing in your house. And the market models really changed in that people aren't necessarily seeking ownership of these things so long as they have access to these things. Studios make a larger percentage of the money on opening weekend than the theaters, and then eventually, like, each week that changes, where theaters make a little bit more and studios make a little bit less, which is why studios like, you know, big opening weekends. And for theaters, it's usually better, you know, the longer the movie has legs. I think it'd be interesting if fewer people are going en masse to a movie on opening weekend and are maybe automatically kind of pacing out and spacing out when they see, like, oh, you know what, I'll wait 2-3 weeks when the theater isn't as packed and see it. Or even like in a second run theater, which was always one of my favorite formats for going to a movie, because it was like, you know, something you could rent or pay a dollar and see on the big screen. It's like, oh yeah, you know. I think it'd be interesting if theaters benefit from people delaying coming back to a movie until maybe its third week, because then the theater automatically gets a little bit more money.
All throughout quarter two, media pundits and gadflies have been speculating about whether or not Warner Brothers' decision to release films on streaming at the same time they released in theaters was hurting the box office. Flagging numbers at the box office seemed to say that a recovery was not imminent. However, by looking at the release schedule, you would see that the biggest movies of the year were not going to arrive until the end of quarter two, and really in the beginning of quarter three, and most of them arriving at the end of quarter four. So with the first half of the year already over, and the box office not really rebounding, but more states opening, more theaters opening, and more big tentpole movies being released in the next 6 months than perhaps any other time in movie history, the question I posed to Jake was this: how do we know in quarter three, the immediate future, if the recovery is real? When should we begin celebrating as movie fans or corporations? And when should we start to worry? What would be the first film, the first litmus test of whether or not the box office was healthy and consumers felt safe going back to the theater?
If the numbers return, it might, I mean, it's not going to be like, I don't know if, I honestly don't think, just because of both the pandemic and also because of kind of their restart, like it's going to be a while before Marvel probably gets another $1 billion from a single film. A lot of the companies with like established intellectual property all seem to be kind of in like a reset mode, as it was, where they were having to rethink and re-strategize and put a new spin on the stuff they owned. Maybe with the exception of Universal and the Fast and the Furious, because, like, you know, they pretty much know what they're doing, and that got pushed back. But I think that's going to do fine, and that's probably going to be the first one that you see make numbers that don't reflect any effect of the pandemic, perhaps. That's a franchise that goes back 20 years. That first one came out, what, 2001? You've got people who grew up watching those, and I think that's like when I, like here at home, when I was watching movies, some of my favorite things were going back and either revisiting stuff from the 90s or just like seeing things like, you know, I never saw this and it was out when I was in high school, and I wonder how it holds up. And just kind of like that feeling of going back to even, and it's weird to think of a simpler time being 20 years ago, but it was. It was. I think that's going to be probably a nice comfort to people to see. And they'll go spend time with that crew. Whereas Black Widow necessarily, Scarlett Johansson's the recognizable face. Everyone else in the movie is pretty much kind of being introduced. And I think it'll do really well. But I think probably Fast 9 success is gonna decide how, you know, what the rest of 2021 and probably into the beginning of 2022 looks like for movies of that size.
If you had to make a prediction for 2021, what would it be? When we look back on this year, as far as it relates to movies, cinema, what do you think the history books will say?
We've seen a trend over the past 20 years where studios were only interested in big budget things that could sell to a worldwide audience, and middle budget projects, as far as movies go, were kind of relegated to something that either had to be redeveloped for TV or put directly onto a streamer like Netflix. They weren't really interested in romantic comedies, courtroom dramas, things that don't cost that much. Maybe that changes because, one, you've got individual streaming services where you can put that kind of content and it does well. And two, you know, if you have a really big crew working, you have a lot of, and I haven't worked on a set throughout this whole experience, so I'm not sure how much the testing has changed now with the vaccine being more widely available, like if it's still as persistent, or if they're not doing it nearly as much as long as everyone's vaccinated. But since that takes up so much of your budget, I wouldn't be surprised if they kind of think like, maybe we can see how we do, you know, something that doesn't cost as much, which, I mean, it's funny when you think about like the original big draw of the movies for movie makers, as far as, you know, back in the original, you know, when it was first getting started over 100 years ago, was they weren't that expensive to make, like the cameras in the film, yes, but essentially like the talent, you were creating stars, but you weren't necessarily paying them what stars see today. And the movies were relatively inexpensive, but they made so much because it was that or radio. So of course people kept, you know, just over and over again buying tickets and things like that. Anyway, my prediction is that you might see just a general shift in what they're putting out based on what they can afford.
What's your prediction for movie theaters?
My prediction for movie theaters is that you'll see fewer chains. You'll see some companies buying up some of the available venues. For example, AMC, I believe, is in talks to acquire the Pacific Theater locations out here in the city that are located at some of the more popular outdoor malls, which would give more theaters to AMC, because then they'd have one at Universal City, Century City, and then also in Glendale at the Americana, and like kind of these really populated high traffic areas where people go see movies all the time, where I saw movies all the time. So you probably see fewer, like there's also down the street from me, there's a very small 3-theater megaplex called Los Feliz 3. And they would usually show like 2 studio movies and then one independent one that you maybe weren't familiar with. And I noticed driving past the other day that it seems like they were purchased by the American Cinematheque, which also owns the Egyptian Theater. And I think maybe Netflix acquired the Egyptian Theater from the American Cinematheque. But I think you're gonna see theaters buying up smaller venues and venues that had to be sold by the prior owner, whether it's Pacific or Regal or something else. So you might see Cinemark take over a couple more spots and AMC take over a couple more spots, I think.
Do you see the Cinemarks and the AMCs being purchased by the Netflixes and Amazons?
I was wondering that a year ago, and I even like with my coworkers, even though we were all pretty much at home throughout 2021, we had a Facebook group going. And I even asked, like, put the question out there, like, do you think with the Paramount decrees repealed that studios would be interested in buying theaters again? And other folks were saying, like, to be honest, right now working at this person's, like, assistant desk, I kind of am privy to these conversations, and they're really way more interested in the streaming options, which makes sense because if you own a theater, you got to clean it, you got to staff it,
yes,
you got to maintain right. it. If you own a streaming service, you got to debug it, you got to
right.
That's about it. So it's
right. You're paying for a server as opposed to wages, and there's a lot more overhead in
yes.
the theatrical.
Less real yeah. estate, yeah, less everything. So they were like, that's yeah. an interesting thought, but to be honest, like right now, they're really all in on and trying to build up the streamers that they own.
All throughout quarter one and quarter two, many op-ed pieces were written posing the question, were movie theaters a passé pastime from a bygone era?
Well, I mean, we still have radio. We still have normal broadcast radio. Tune a dial to catch a frequency and listen to the news or a song or whatever, even though there's no shortage of direct-to-consumer audio streaming options for whatever you want, you know, like Sirius, you know, podcast, things like that. We still have radio, and the stations are still up. So I think it's like that. And yeah, like 100 years ago, you had radio, you had movies, and we still have them. even though technology is completely different from 100 years ago, we still have those two things.
Let me ask you one bonus question here. Amazon acquiring the MGM library.
Yeah, that was also big too, because so they're looking to like Bond and all those movies, because now they can make Pink Panther movies and like MGM's library, like, of classic films predating a certain date have kind of changed hands quite a bit over the course of like the last 40 years, and different people buying the library, but getting the rights to make those things and owning those, that's kind of a big thing. I don't know if they would even keep that MGM label on those movies anymore. Like, I don't know if you'd see necessarily, because like a lot of times, like if Warner Media buys New Line Cinema, you still see the New Line Cinema logo in front of New Line Movies because they're operating within that company. But I'd be curious if they want to even still keep the MGM logo around. It is iconic with the lion, but you know, maybe they're just interested in pushing their own brand and being like, no, we just want to make these Amazon.
I don't know that, is there that much pushback for Bezos, who I know is stepping down, but is there that much pushback against Amazon acquiring MGM, or does the MGM brand just not mean as much today as it maybe it did to a past generation of filmgoer?
I'd be surprised, like, quite honestly, and this comes from actually working with, like, working at a studio and getting to interact and speak with folks who just went to go see movies in the theaters, both casually and as diehard fans. Most of the time, not everyone, save for if it's, you know, when you think of it's an animated film, you think, oh, that's Disney or Pixar. But other than that, I just don't think there's a lot of brand loyalty between people and their entertainment compared to people and like the computers they own or the car they own. I don't think it's necessarily as strong. And that just comes from my years of like talking to people and like tour guides would often make the mistake of being like, what are your favorite Warner Brothers movies? And people would be like, I don't know what the, like, what do you guys make? like Mission Impossible, is that you? Or like, you know, and, or you'd bring up, you'd bring up other movies from other studios that shot on the studio lot and have to explain that was actually another studio renting a soundstage or a backlot from us rather than our movie. Because it'd be like, oh, do you sell that in your store? It's like, oh, no, we don't actually own that movie. They filmed it here. Yeah, if you're losing the MGM name in front of, like, I don't think they'd like strip it away from something like Gone with the Wind, or which actually they don't own, because I think Warner still owns that. But like moving forward, like I could probably see like, I don't know, maybe a combined logo, like the Amazon theater venue and then the like an updated lion preceding it, with, you know, of course, underneath like an Amazon Studios company or something like that. That would be the weird thing, is like MGM, an Amazon Studios company.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
One of the big benefits of the AT&T Warner Media thing was you got a discount for having AT&T service for being a Warner Media employee, and so that was nice. Like, funny story, like we were on Sprint and not happy, so we switched to AT&T and got new phones like literally a week and a half before the tour closed down. and so then the service continued, thankfully, but then once they let me go, the service ended like, you know, the next day, so they were really keeping tabs on that. That being said, however, I was a Warner Media employee when I signed up for HBO Max, and then a couple months in, I switched the user email from my work email to my personal email, and I'm happy to say I'm still paying the employee rate for HBO, which is substantially less than the normal consumer retail price for a subscription. I keep checking, like every month I'll be like, oh, it's still okay, all right, they haven't caught on yet, all right. So personally, yeah, this is very selfish, is that with Discovery and Warner Media emerging, I fear probably that might come to an end and I'll actually have to pay the $15. I hope that's not the case.
Special thanks to my guest, Jake Thomas. There's a line in the Stephen King novella and film adaptation Stand By Me, where the author of the novella and the film, as played by Richard Dreyfuss, writes, "I never had any friends later on, like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, does anyone? You can follow Jake on Twitter at JTHummus, and make sure to check out his film, Shedding, which is available now on Amazon Prime and iTunes. I'll make sure to put a link in the show notes. We'd like to keep the conversation going, so if you have thoughts about the second quarter of 2021 or anything that was said here or not said here, please feel free to email the show, bingemovies@gmail.com, or contact us via Twitter @bingemovies. I'd really like to hear from you.